funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Does self-help actually work? Market analysts value the industry somewhere between $11 and $13 billion a year in the United States alone, catering to Americans looking to improve their health, relationships, business skills, and financial prospects. My guest today has explored the field herself, reading hundreds of books and attending seminars promising to teach attendees to find husbands, conquer the fear of flying, even to write a best-selling self-help book. But as she'll tell us, her greatest challenge in recent years has been in finding a way to talk to her own father, a psychologist and self-help author himself, about the turbulent childhood that followed her mother's early departure from her life. The new memoir by Jessica Lamb Shapiro is called Promised Land, My Journey Through America's Self-Help Culture. Jessica, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I will confess, I had no idea that the self-help genre has such ancient roots, but it seems that as long as we've had writing, we've had people writing advice.
Yeah, I didn't know that either before I started. I thought of it as kind of a 1960s, 1970s phenomenon, but it turned out the Victorians were really into self-help. And when I started looking at self-help as more advice books or advice on self-improvement, I could see that parts of the Bible, ancient Greek literature, ancient Egyptian literature all had elements of things that today's self-help books also have.
And the kinds of things that people sought help with have been remarkably consistent over time.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, relationships, health, success. That's about it.
So you opened the book with a conference that you attended with your father, who himself has published more than 40 books of self-help. Some of them are workbooks, but he failed to be or had failed to be a runaway success at this. What kind of advice was he writing, first of all?
He was writing parenting books. Like you said, he's a child psychologist, so that was his area of expertise.
Mm-hmm. And the irony is that your father seems to have struggled to communicate openly with you or in a way that worked for you about the death of your mother just before you turned two. What did you know about her and about her life?
I knew very little. Part of it was that I was afraid to ask questions because I saw that when I did have a question, he would get very upset. And just the kind of kid I was very non-confrontational, as is my dad, so I just didn't ask any more questions. So I really didn't know much about her. I didn't even know very simple facts like when she died, when her birthday was, what she did while she was alive.
Your dad does seem to have done his best to sort of point you toward optimism. He would ask you what day it was, and there was one right answer.
Yes. Whenever my dad asked me what day it was, the correct answer was, today is the first day of the rest of my life. Sort of programmed me to say that over 18 years.
Was that the kind of thing that, like, as you moved into adolescence, you would roll your eyes at, or was it just how your dad was?
You know, I did roll my eyes at him, and my dad is kind of a jokey guy, so it was never even clear to me how serious he was. Mm-hmm. It's always hard to tell with my dad if he's kidding or not.
What did you think when you found out that he wanted to attend this seminar that we should say was given by the guy behind the Chicken Soup for the Soul books?
Exactly. I was really surprised because, for one thing, that's not the kind of book that my dad writes. And I knew that he'd always wanted to have a bigger audience, more like Dr. Phil or someone. But he'd also had so much experience. I mean, at that time, he'd written over 40 self-help books, so I wasn't sure what he thought they would have to teach him that he didn't already know. And I guess that was the allure, is that there might be some secret that he wasn't aware of, and if only he knew it, he would reach another level of success.
So for those who haven't picked up one of these Chicken Soup books, the basic premise is just, like, inspirational stories. Is that right?
Exactly. They're just inspirational stories. And interestingly enough, one of the earliest books that people consider a self-help book was a book called Self-Help by Samuel Smiles in 1859. And it's exactly like Chicken Soup for the Soul. It's basically just stories of people maybe born to poor surroundings, overcoming hardship against all odds and rising to be, you know, titans of industry.
So how did it happen that you said, sure, I'll go along with you and we can check this thing out together?
Well, it sounded strange, and I just happened to be in a time in my life where I just finished grad school and I didn't have much to do, so I just agreed to go along. It was just a weekend, so I figured, you know, well, this will be something interesting to check out.
What kind of promises were made by the organizers of the workshop, or implied, maybe?
They would know they were pretty much made. There weren't so much implied. I mean, they were pretty confident in their formula. They were extremely confident that people needed self-help and that all you had to do was provide it. And I remember one woman saying, you know, that she heard about a book called Knitting with Dog Hair. And she thought that was the most ridiculous idea in the world. But lo and behold, it was like this huge best-selling book. Apparently, there are many, many people who want to know how to knit with dog hair. So that kind of told me something that it was really a world I wasn't understanding if that was considered a good idea and a successful idea.
Yeah, and if she's got the secret, goodness, it should come to you at some point, right?
You'd think.
So
the people in the audience seemed to react very positively to that because I think everybody was thinking, well, geez, like I could think of something better than that.
Yeah, it sounds like an almost, for some of the people who attended, and we should say your dad was not among them, it was almost like a religious experience for some of them.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's what struck me the most about the conference and what led me on the path to start this book was how emotional people were. Lots of people were crying. They were clearly very excited. After about 2 hours, they were running into the hallway and they were calling their loved ones on their cell phones and they were saying things like, I'm so excited. I just had to call you. I just had the most amazing experience of my life. And I had been in the same room and I hadn't had the most amazing experience of my life. I was really bewildered, but in a way that I was also really intrigued. I just thought, what is going on here? You know, why are these people so excited? Why are they so moved? You know, what's happening?
Do you think that self-help appeals to our inherent optimism or our inherent pessimism?
Oh, that's a good question. I think probably it appeals more to our inherent optimism. Self-help books are basically about hope and aspiration. And especially with inspirational stories like Chicken Soup for the Soul, the whole premise of an inspirational story is that if you can do something, then I can do it too. And it's not even made explicit. It's just when you hear about somebody who was born into great hardship and then achieved a lot, you just automatically project yourself into that situation and project it back onto you and think, well, that's inspiring to me. And that gives you hope and that gives you motivation to try to do something. So I think it's more appealing to optimism.
And we do, I mean, we like inspirational stories. Even people who sort of scoff at these things can get surprisingly taken in by hard luck triumph stories.
Oh, I was so surprised because I found myself loving them. I mean, mm-hmm. I was so skeptical and so cynical, but they're just irresistible. I mean, they're just these amazing stories with happy endings, and you automatically get invested because the conflict is so immediate and so dire. And then when it turns out well, you're just happy. I found the power of them really amazing.
We should say that your father asked for his money back after this seminar, but you continue to hear from and receive presents from the Chicken Soup for the Soul people?
Yes, I did. Well, my dad paid for my ticket. And so he asked for both of, you know, the money for his ticket and for my ticket back. And they had a full refund policy and they did give it to him to their credit. But I guess maybe they took his name out of a computer but didn't take my name out of a computer. So ever since to this day, I still get emails from Mark Victor Hansen, who was the co-author of The Chicken Soup for the Soul guy, asking me if I'd like to be a healthpreneur or, you know, if I'm single and I would like to, you know, learn something about being in relationships. And I also got a silver platter in the mail that was inscribed with the words, "Who says nothing is ever handed to you on a silver platter?" I still don't even know exactly what that meant, but I was so delighted by it.
Were you encouraged at any point in the seminar to be an actual expert in the things that you might write a self-help book about?
Well, we were all considered experts just by existing, in a sense. Mm-hmm. That was kind of the idea of the seminars, that anybody can write a book. So whatever it is that you think you know about, you know about it and you're the expert. You know, knitting with dog hair. All you have to do is learn to do it. Then you're the expert on knitting with dog hair. So, I mean, I think that's the appeal of self-help for a lot of people who want to write it, is that you don't have to go to school. There's no training. There's no regulating board. There's nobody to stop you. Maybe people won't buy it. That's the only downside. But you can pretty much just decide to be an expert on anything. There was a woman that I met who loved Disney. Like, mm-hmm. That was her absolute favorite thing in the world. And she was writing a book on how to make your home more like Disney, right, based on Disney principles. She lived in Celebration, Florida, mm-hmm. which is that Disney town.
Right.
And, you know, she was an expert. She went to Disney a lot. She lived in Celebration, and she had a lot of ideas on how to do it. Now, I don't know that that idea would appeal to that many people, but she was extremely enthusiastic. And, you know, in whatever sense you can be an expert on how to make your home more like Disney, she was definitely an expert.
One of her ideas was like, have an opening time. So she would get up like hours before anyone else in the family and get the house all ready to maximize the enjoyment of the rest of her family.
Yes. It seems like a great deal of self-sacrifice to me.
It does.
One that was unappealing, but, you know, she seemed really into it.
So it's hard, I know, to generalize, and you're careful here, you know, to not to generalize about an entire genre of books. But suffice it to say, some of these things may be well-written and well-researched, and others may just be nonsense.
That is exactly correct.
Tell us about some of the nonsense that you found. There were those books, The Secret, right, where you just have to sort of... I mean, I haven't read them, but it's like kind of wish for it and it will come to you.
Yeah, The Secret is based on this idea called the law of attraction, which is not a real law, but people refer to it as one anyway. And one of the things that annoyed me about The Secret is that the law of attraction has been around for about 100 years. It's not a secret. It's been written about by so many books. 1913, 1945. These were huge best-selling books that talked about this idea of the law of attraction. So I was immediately annoyed because somebody comes along and basically regurgitates an idea that people have been talking about for 100 years and calls it a secret. But yeah, the basic idea is that if you think of something, you attract that thing to you, and then that thing will happen.
And it's sort of a brilliant thing to write a book about and to make money on, because if it doesn't work, you can always blame the customer, right? They didn't want it enough, or they didn't surround themselves with enough positive thinking.
Exactly. They didn't believe enough. And the real dark side of the book, which I think is why it bothered me so much, is that it actually went as far as to say that if bad things happen to you, it's your fault because you attracted those things to you. And, you know, when you think about the level of bad things that can happen to people, it's really hard to, for me, it just seems really ungenerous to blame something like, you know, the Holocaust on the Holocaust victims because they were attracting, you know, negative Nazi attention.
I suppose, though, the simplicity of these books and the promises they make, that's one of the big draws, right? If you can just get through 300 pages, you will be in this small group of people with this special kind of knowledge.
Oh, exactly. I mean, everybody wants a magic cure. Obviously, The Secret was hugely popular. I think it's the whole Secret book and the movie made something like $300 million. So clearly people want this kind of information, and they're really willing to accept it.
You also spent some time at a seminar for The Rules, which was this really big phenomenon a few years back of essentially training women to train men to ask them to marry them.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, The Rules was a book that was a bestseller in 1995, but they are still going strong. They've had sequels, they teach classes, they train other women to teach classes. So they've got kind of a whole... I wouldn't say Ponzi scheme exactly, but they are definitely like teaching other people to spread the message of The Rules.
We'll talk a little bit more about Jessica Lamb Shapiro's experiences with The Rules in just a moment. Her new book is called Promised Land, My Journey Through America's Self-Help Culture. If you'd like to join the conversation, perhaps share your experience with self-help, we would love to hear from you at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Jessica Lamb Shapiro. Her new memoir is called Promised Land, My Journey Through America's Self-Help Culture. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Jessica, you went to this seminar given by the creators of the rules. I have to ask, did you go thinking that it would just be research for the book, but think maybe I can learn something and meet a nice guy?
I'm always open to learning things. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the reasons that I went for some reason is that I remember it coming out when I was in high school. 1995 was the year I graduated from high school, and I just remember hearing about it and being kind of intrigued, but also kind of embarrassed to look at it. So I never ended up buying the book, and, you know, maybe, the, you know, I guess it was 14 years later, I was still curious about what they had to say.
So you show up like, you know, you hadn't washed your hair that day, you're in sweatpants, and you've already, like, broken 9 rules when you show up.
Yeah, I mean, the basic idea of the rules is that you always have to look perfect. And as a writer, I stay at home all day. I have a dog. I'm covered in dog hair. That's just not my thing. But I didn't really realize kind of what a bad idea that was until I showed up and I was in a room full of women who all looked perfect. Mm-hmm. And then I started to feel bad about myself.
Hmm. And the idea, I guess, is that, you control the behavior of men that you're interested in by keeping yourself away from them.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's a really extreme version of playing hard to get. They say that if a man calls you, you need to set a timer for 10 minutes, and then after 10 minutes, you get off the phone no matter what. You're not allowed to go on a date during the week. You're only allowed to accept Saturday night dates, and you're not allowed to talk to them very much. And so the idea is to pretend that you're not interested in order to make them more interested. And they had a sort of pseudoscientific reason for this, which is that biologically men are aggressors and that you have to kind of tap into that aggression, that sort of male animal aggression, in order to get them to marry you.
There's a weird kind of sexism that comes into play there, too, because it does say that, you know, you have to essentially make yourself appear, let him be the one who's in charge, thinks he's in charge of these major decisions.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, in that sense, it's kind of sexist because you're letting the man have control. But then the woman actually has control because they're manipulating the entire situation.
So tell us about the woman that was held up in the seminar that you attended as like the proof that this stuff works.
This is sort of one of the more surprising encounters that I had in this book. They had brought in a woman who had done the rules. Her name was Betsy. And the idea was to sort of inspire us. I mean, it was the same idea as an inspirational story, except it was an actual person who was going to give us the inspirational story about how great the rules were. And the first thing she said was, you know, "Hi, my name is Betsy, and I'm the ultimate rules girl because I got married twice in 1 year." And everybody seemed really delighted by this. And I just kind of thought, what? You know... You'd get married twice. I mean, obviously that implies that the first marriage failed, and that's not a good thing. But, you know, I kind of thought, well, it's going to be a happy story. This is going to be great. And at that point, I had really learned to love inspirational stories. Mm-hmm. I love a happy ending. I'm kind of sentimental and a sucker on the inside. So I was like, oh, this is going to be fun. We're going to listen to this happy story. And then she proceeds to tell about how she met this guy, did the rules. He proposed within 5 months, which in my opinion is pretty quick. Mm-hmm. She didn't really get to know him. And then while they were planning the wedding, she started to see that he had what she called anger issues. And basically, he was verbally abusive. She alluded to the fact that he was later physically abusive. She said she hated him, and then she divorced him. And at this point in the story, I was like, why is this woman here? Like, this is a terrible, sad story. This is not, you know, I have really studied inspirational stories and you are like so off book here. You know, you are just not allowed to go to this place. And then there was sort of a happy ending because she immediately went out and did the rules again and met her next husband and he proposed in 2 months. And then her final words were sort of like, my divorce just came through yesterday and I got married this morning. Yay. You know, and everybody clapped and they were so excited. And I was just looking around the room thinking, like, I still don't understand how this is a happy story. Like, this is a really disturbing story. But I was really the only one, at least that I could tell, that felt that way, because the first woman who raised her hand to ask a question said, you know, I'm so excited for you. This is such a heartwarming story. Hmm. And I just thought, it is? How is this a heartwarming story?
I wonder if books like this, when we are feeling a little lost for whatever reason, they not only tell us that they've got the solution to our problems, but they help reshape what it is we think we want.
I think that's true to some extent, yeah. And it also helps us feel like we're in control. And I think not being in control is one of the more frustrating things for human beings, especially when it relates to dealing with other human beings and relationships. It's sort of annoying that you can't control other people. I think that we should just accept that and deal with it. But I can definitely see the appeals of books that tell you that, yes, you actually can control other human beings.
So, Jessica, your dad is a child psychologist and a good guy. You are a professional communicator. You're a writer. Why do you think it was such a struggle for you to be comfortable talking about your feelings in your childhood and then your young adulthood?
I think part of it was that my dad was a very positive guy, and I think that he taught me inadvertently to try to just be cheery and be positive, and talking about death just wasn't part of that. There were a few times that I tried to bring it up, and I could tell that he was getting very sad, and I felt very protective of him. I didn't want to make him sad, so I always backed off really quickly. I think I kind of misread that his being sad was a terrible thing, and if I had continued to ask questions, I might have found that out. But I also kind of colluded in this collegial atmosphere where, you know, everything was okay and we didn't talk about bad things. And that was sort of how we got on. And I think right after my mother died, it was necessary to some extent. And then at some point, you know, 20, 30 years had gone by and it was no longer necessary, but it was a habit and it became very hard to break that habit.
Yeah, it does seem sometimes that we are more afraid of seeing pain in someone we love than we are even of experiencing it ourselves.
Oh, absolutely. And especially when you bring up a subject, it almost feels like you're causing the pain.
Mm-hmm. So you don't go into too much detail here, but reading between the lines, it seemed to me that your father, reeling after your mom died, sort of jumped into a marriage that was not an ideal match. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Okay.
That is completely accurate.
Yeah. And so when that marriage failed, were you able to talk about that and the experience and how it had affected you?
No. I mean, I think that I felt it was really important to seem okay all the time. And I'm not sure to what extent those signals came from my dad because it was not something he explicitly said, or to what extent, you know, maybe that's just part of my personality. But I definitely really valued seeming okay and seeming fine over expressing my feelings.
Did other people in your life, like, you know, friends in school and that sort of thing, did they strike you as just sort of wantonly emotional when they were comfortable being, you know, having a bad day and letting it show?
Oh, totally. Hmm. I like, didn't understand children. I remember, I think I was 12 or 13, and a friend of mine started telling me about she'd had the worst day of her life because her brother had taped over a television show that she had taped, and she was crying. And I just looked at her, and I thought, why are you crying? This is the craziest thing I've ever heard. You know, I think I had a little bit of a superiority complex about it, that I was so tough and so strong and nothing could get me. And, you know, then when other kids would sort of express emotion, I would just think like, weak children.
And I guess that's helpful in a way because it feels like it's protecting you from the really painful stuff. But it also, I guess, puts a governor on your ability to experience joyful emotions.
Absolutely. You know, it's one of those things that was helpful when I was a child and things might have been too complicated and too difficult for me to understand. But then I just carried it through into adulthood and then it became difficult for me to connect with people and have normal, open relationships.
And in defense of all the adults in your life, the way that your mother died was complicated and can sort of throw a layer onto grief that doesn't always exist.
Absolutely.
Were you able to understand that even when you were pondering why nobody wanted to talk about this thing?
I think I was to some extent. My mother died right before my second birthday, and she committed suicide, and nobody told me that. They told me she'd died in a car accident. And I think they thought, and were probably correct, that I wouldn't really, you know, I wasn't really capable of understanding death at that age, much less self-inflicted death. And so then they told me the truth. I don't remember exactly when, but it was around when I was 7 or 8. And I don't know that I exactly really understood what that meant then. You know, they said that she was depressed, and yeah, I didn't really understand what depression was at that age. But, you know, it was so important to me that I seem adult and grown up and competent and capable that I just sort of said, yes, I understand. That's fine. When really I didn't. I had so many questions, and there were so many things I didn't understand, but it just didn't feel comfortable for me to ask those questions. And then it was kind of embarrassing, you know, when I was in my 20s to still not know the answers and have to ask them when it was less age appropriate.
Yeah. And then you carried around with you this fear that you had a hard time expressing to other people, but you were afraid that because your mom had taken her own life, that somehow the same fate awaited you, although you had not struggled with really profound depression.
Yeah, I think because I didn't really understand the circumstances around what had happened to her, and to some extent, you know, I never will. I wasn't there. I have no memory of it. And suicide is just a really hard to comprehend thing. I just sort of thought, well, maybe it's just something that happens to you. You know, mm-hmm. like it just overtakes you. You don't know it's coming. And it's just like attacks you in some way. I mean, it wasn't a very rational thought. And I knew it wasn't rational. And so I never told anybody about it. So I just kept it to myself. And I was kind of living day to day, week to week anyway, so I wasn't too concerned. I thought, well, it's in the future, you know. But then as I started to approach my 32nd birthday,
the age that when she died.
Well, funnily enough, she wasn't that age, but I just thought she was. I mean, this is what happens when you don't communicate, is like you have all these wrong ideas. So it turned out she was actually 31 when she died. So when I was preparing for this, you know, thing to happen, it had already passed. I didn't even know that. But yeah, so I was kind of thinking, like, I was getting nervous. And I was just thinking, like, oh, is something just going to happen to me? Am I just going to become possessed? And then I read this book called Motherless Daughters, and it said that 90% of women whose mothers commit suicide fear that the same will happen to them. And there was a name for it. It was called the parental trigger. And it just explained that when you don't see your parent get old and you don't see your parent past a certain age, it's almost impossible for you to conceive of yourself past a certain age. And that information just made so much sense to me that I just stopped being afraid of it entirely. I just thought, oh, well, that makes sense. It's normal. Hmm. And then I literally never had the thought again.
So there was some good that came out of what is, I suppose, at least nominally, a self-help sort of book.
Yeah, Motherless Daughters, I believe, is a self-help book.
Mm-hmm. So can you talk about how you undertook, how you decided to get involved with a group that works with grieving children?
Well, when I started to read books on grief, that's kind of when I realized that the book was taking a more personal turn. Mm-hmm. I hadn't really set out to write a memoir or write about my mother at all. But when I was reading these self-help on grief, it really started to dawn on me that, you know, I was dealing with something that I hadn't really dealt with, and that this was, you know, kind of an opportunity for me to tangle with that a little bit. And I just was looking into different grief organizations, and it was just a Google search, and I found this camp, and I was really attracted to it because it was kids. And, you know, I was a kid when I lost my mother, and it was so the opposite of my own experience, which was nobody really even acknowledged that it had happened. It just wasn't talked about at all. And here you have an organization where kids are going away. They're sitting around in what they call healing circles, which are kind of like support groups. And they're talking with counselors about their experience, and they're talking with other kids about their experience. So, you know, on some level, I think I maybe just wanted to experience that vicariously. But it was also really fascinating to me that there was another way that this kind of thing could be dealt with.
Did you have to steel yourself to go into what you knew would be an emotionally intense experience?
I did to some extent. You know, I think most of the experiences that I had in this book, I was much more terrified than I needed to be. They ended up being really not all that scary experiences. But yeah, I was afraid. I was, you know, kind of had a nervous breakdown, or I thought, you know, I would just be crying the whole weekend because it was going to be so sad. But I have to say they did a really good job of making it fun, which is a radical thing to say about a grief camp. But there was actually, you know, there were these support groups, but then there was a lot of time that was like playing tag and going swimming. And there was definitely kids having fun, which was also a really amazing thing to see because these were kids who had very recently lost a parent or a sibling. So to see them just kind of enjoying themselves was pretty great.
And I guess it's pretty normal for them to vacillate, right, between moments where they're overwhelmed and moments where they feel pretty normal.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't think kids could really handle 48 hours of grief counseling.
So how did you make the decision? This is a separate experience, we should stress, to walk across hot coals.
I was interested in positive thinking. And one of the things that had come up in my research was mind over matter. This idea that our minds can control our bodies. And firewalking is something that's a big part of a lot of self-help retreats because they tell the people who firewalk that if they have an intention in their mind, which is basically like a mantra and the idea that they're powerful enough to not get hurt, that they won't get hurt. So this sounded very suspicious to me. So I decided to go do it for myself and just see what the deal was. And because of the kind of person I am, I researched it to a hilt. And by the time I got there, I knew everything about firewalking. And I knew that actually the reason you don't get hurt is because of physics. Wood is just a poor insulator for heat. And so as long as you move fast enough, that's why you don't get burned. I mean, the ashes basically coat the coals and protect your feet from the heat. Despite that, I was still really terrified because at the end of the day, you're in a dark, you know, very dark situation where you can't see anything but glowing coals and you're about to put your bare feet on them. And I think there's just something animal in you that reacts and just says, this is not a good idea.
And so did getting across them successfully have a surprisingly profound impact for you?
I felt really great about myself because I had done something that I was scared about. But on the other hand, I also felt sort of lame because, you know, I knew that it was just physics and it wasn't anything that I had done to make my feet not get burned.
Jessica Lamb Shapiro is with us from the studios of NPR in New York City. We're talking about her new memoir, Promised Land, My Journey Through America's Self-Help Culture. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Jessica Lamb Shapiro. Her new book is called Promised Land, My Journey Through America's Self-Help Culture. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Lacey who says, I was just curious as to what role you think the power of suggestion and the placebo effect play in self-help books.
I mean, they definitely play a role. It's such a hard thing to tell. And I guess my attitude on that is, what's so bad about a placebo effect? You know, if you're looking to feel better and you do feel better, it doesn't really matter if it's real or not real.
And I suppose it's just something that you can't give too much thought to when you are reading a book that seems to have helpful advice in it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can't believe that something is going to absolutely fix your life anyway. So you're basically just trying on different ideas. And, you know, I think you should read self-help books for the information. And then that information may make you feel better. It may spur you to some action. But it's basically just about getting information.
So I want to go back to this idea of expertise that we touched on a little bit earlier. You have a really interesting account of how your father became, for a time, sort of the national expert on something that was identified as a threat to, like, you know, teenagers and adolescents based on being dubbed so by the media. And it was kind of this weird, vicious circle. Can you explain what happened?
Yeah, I mean, that was a really fascinating thing to be behind the scenes of. So at some point, I guess it was around 2006, there's this thing called the choking game, which I had never heard of, but I guess kids choke each other, and then when they cut off oxygen to the brain, they get a brief high feeling. And so it's just sort of a way of getting a cheap high if you're really, really bored. I had never done this when I was a kid, but it turned out that a lot of my friends had. So someone called my dad about it and said, you know, would you like to come on the show and talk about it? And he said, sure. And he didn't even know what it was. He called me. I didn't know what it was. But, you know, he eventually figured it out. So once he went on this one show, the next time it happened, the producer Googled, you know, the choking game expert, and my dad's name came up. You know, he had talked about it once, but that obviously did not qualify him as an expert. And then that just continued to happen exponentially. So soon he was going on, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 10 shows. And the ironic thing for my dad was that he'd always wanted to, you know, have more of a media presence and sort of have his books better received, but not for this. I mean, he was so not interested in the choking game. He found it really upsetting. And he wasn't even sure that talking about it was a good idea because I guess when you talk about it, more people learn about it and there's a chance they'll do it. So, you know, it could even potentially be harmful to kind of be advertising this game.
Yeah, because it can, I mean, it can be fatal if, you know, in particular cases, we should make sure and stress that. But you have this bizarre story that you tell about your dad being invited on by the Dr. Oz show and the producer just absolutely wanting him to say something that would have made a great bumper tease or a great headline. But your dad was like trying so hard to stick with what he knew scientifically.
Yeah, I mean, the producer really wanted my dad to say that the choking game was addictive. And I didn't really even understand why, because it didn't seem that much more dramatic than saying it was deadly.
Mm-hmm.
Both seem bad. So, and that was all my dad was trying to say. He was saying, you know, the producer kept saying, well, you know, I'm going to ask you if it's addictive. And my dad said, well, it's not addictive. And the producer just kept arguing with him. And my dad said, well, I can say it's dangerous because it's sometimes fatal and it's extremely dangerous. And for some reason, the producer just would not let go of this idea that it had to be addictive. So the compromise they came to was that Dr. Oz was going to ask my dad, Dr. Shapiro, is the choking game addictive? And my dad was going to say, no, but it is very dangerous. And it just was so strange to me to watch this interaction where they just were so insistent on having this word addictive in it for reasons that it didn't really seem to make any sense to me.
Yeah, the whole account, and we admire your father reading this because he, you know, tried really hard to stick with what he knew scientifically, but it does call into question a lot of the sort of expert reports that we might see on TV.
Well, that was kind of my point, because in the first place, my dad was not really an expert on the choking game. He is a child psychologist. He has written a lot of parenting books. So in that sense, he's qualified to comment on it. But I don't think there's any such thing as an expert in the choking game. There's no school that you can go to or studies that you can really undertake, at least not that I know of. So that was one layer. And then there was this other layer where the producer was trying to get him to say something that he didn't even believe about the choking game. So it really was kind of distressing, just the whole scene, having those two layers, and none of that was represented to the television public.
So you sought out help, Jessica, to deal with your fear of flying. Before we talk about how you did that, how did you come to recognize that this was a real impediment in your life?
I couldn't go anywhere. I mean, I just, when I was about 19, I just started getting panic attacks on planes. And so as soon as I did that, I just stopped flying. And it was about 10 years that I didn't fly. I would be invited to friends' weddings and really fun vacations and things that I would have liked to do. But I just drove everywhere. And I once took the train to Seattle just to avoid flying from New York.
And so you knew logically that flying was less dangerous than a lot of other modes of transportation, but I suppose when you have a phobia, logic, even if you are aware of it, doesn't matter because emotionally it's so powerful, that fear.
Yeah, I mean, your body goes into a flight or fight response, and it's so powerful that you just want to trust your body more than you trust your mind because you're thinking, well, my body wouldn't be telling me to run, if I didn't really need to run. So I must know something that other people don't know.
Hmm. Okay, so where did you go hoping to fix this thing?
So there was a class that was being taught at the Westchester, New York airport. And one of the things I liked about the class is that it was actually taught at the airport. And I hadn't even been to an airport in 10 years. And so in a sense, that's a really important thing to just go to the airport and get in the habit of it. Because the longer you don't do something, the harder it is to start again. So we met for 6 weeks every Tuesday night at the airport. And we would go sit in a little classroom. And then at the end of the class, we would board a stationary plane. And that was kind of funny because the plane was not going anywhere. The whole point was just to get us used to being on the plane. But we all acted like, you know, we were being sent to our death. I mean, I was paranoid that they were going to, you know, take off just to trick us or something. And other people would walk on the plane and just start crying. And, you know, the phobia of flying was so severe that we couldn't even get on a plane that we knew wasn't going anywhere. But it was also very effective because doing that week after week, it finally does start to sink in that nothing's going to happen and that it's not dangerous. And by the third time, I stopped having that fear that they were going to take off because I started to trust them. And you do get desensitized to things when you do them over and over. So that was really helpful.
I'm curious about the effect of being surrounded by other people who share the same phobia, but whose phobia may be rooted in other concerns, and whether that causes you to go, well, that guy's really got a problem, or whether it reinforces some of the fears that you had.
For me personally, it was the former. Mm-hmm. I went to another class even more so earlier, where every time somebody would say what they were afraid of, like they would say, I'm afraid the wings are falling off the plane. And that was not my fear. And I would just think to myself, well, that is just the dumbest thing I've ever heard. And you could see that the other people in the class who didn't have that particular fear were just rolling their eyes and they were like, yeah, whatever. And then the instructor would say, well, who's afraid of turbulence? And then I would get very serious because I was afraid of turbulence. Mm-hmm. And this was the real threat. And you could tell the other people in the room who are afraid of turbulence were like, yes, yes, turbulence is very dangerous. And then the people who were afraid that the wings were going to fall off were looking at us. And they were like, what is wrong with you people? That's ridiculous.
So there's like little clicks in the fear of flying.
Yeah, there are like
these little
factions in the room. And it was so depressing. I mean, it was hilarious, but it was also depressing in a sense because, you know, I think we were all used to being judged by our friends and family for having the phobia in the first place. Yeah. And then here we were, a group that had this in common, and we were judging each other because we didn't find each other's specific fears valid. So that was kind of an amazing thing to witness. And on the other hand, it is kind of nice to be around people who have similar phobias. They do understand what you're going through. So it was really a mixed bag. You know, sometimes it was like looking into a very unflattering mirror. And sometimes I felt like I was part of a community that was not too bad.
It does seem like phobias are a particularly challenging affliction, although they are often treatable or curable. Like everybody in the world is going to go, buck up, this is not actually dangerous. And people seem to have very little sympathy for those with phobias.
It's very hard to understand if you don't have a phobia, yeah, how serious and debilitating a phobia is. I was listening to the radio the other day and I heard someone talking about their phobia of cheese. And I just thought, what? You know, that's a phobia of cheese. And I had to remind myself as somebody who's had a phobia that that's just the nature of a phobia. It just is there and who knows why it's there. You know, maybe you can go to therapy and discover the deep reasons for it. But if you're afraid of cheese, that means that you see cheese and you have a fight or flight response and your heart rate goes up and you start sweating and you feel like you're going to die. You know, that's really what the experience of having a panic attack is. You just feel like you're going to die and it's very frightening. And so just because cheese is in no way scared of me, in fact, really love cheese, you know, I can in some way understand what the experience of having a phobia of cheese might be like.
So if I offered you a free ticket to Aruba right now, would you take it?
I might. I'm getting better at flying. Mm-hmm. I've never been to Aruba.
or somewhere fantastic.
Somewhere fantastic. Yeah. Yes, definitely.
Was there something about being in a group that you think was more helpful than just if you had sort of read the text of everything you experienced in a book?
For me, there was. I kind of liked the social pressure, the peer pressure of it. You know, if I had been just reading a book, my phobia was intense enough that it was uncomfortable. And just to think about and talk about, not even to go to the airport or go on a plane. So very often I would buy these books and I would just stop reading them. But being in a class and having made the effort to go all the way out to the airport, you know, it just meant that I wasn't going to leave. And so in that sense, it just made me more committed to the class. I had another classmate who I spoke to who said that she actually found the books a lot more helpful. She didn't really like the style of the instructor who was leading it. She found that kind of alienating. So, you know, I think for me, yes, that was helpful, but it wasn't that case for everyone.
So ultimately, you had a breakthrough with your father, and we won't go into the exact details. People can read those in the book. But I wonder, after that sort of thing happens, if you still have to fight your natural tendency to fall back into the patterns that you had inhabited for the past 30-some years.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, things just don't change overnight. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the most difficult things, or pernicious things maybe, about self-help, is that they sort of claim that if you read this book, everything's going to be different. And habits are ingrained. And so even when you learn to overcome them, every single time you're in that situation, you kind of have to relearn. And it gets easier with time, but it takes a lot of practice. So I definitely, you know, even to this day, still have trouble talking to him about it, and those old fears about upsetting him and not wanting to change the fun tone of our conversation still come into play. You know, it's been 30 years that we've been doing this, so I assume it'll take a while, if not the rest of my life, to kind of undo that.
One thing that I liked about the book was that you sort of are very open about the fact that you're okay if one thing out of a book with 100 ideas seems to work for you, you'll take that and toss the rest.
I kind of had to have that opinion going in. But I had a funny experience with an ex-boyfriend of mine where he was a smoker, and he said he wanted to quit smoking. And a friend of ours said that she had read the self-help book about quitting smoking, and she had just quit smoking. And so I took a look at the book, and it was filled with too many exclamation points and some sort of silly phrases. And my ex-boyfriend was a big reader and kind of an intellectual and a little bit of a snob. And I thought, he can't read this book the way it is. So I just took a Sharpie and I just crossed out all the sentences that I thought would be annoying to him. You know, anything with an exclamation point, anything that was written in all caps. And so I gave him what looked like kind of a, you know, slightly declassified CIA document. It was like, here's the leftover useful information. Because I feel like for whatever reason, I actually have the ability to read that way with just a mental Sharpie. Mm-hmm. And I can just ignore a sentence that I find irritating and accept the next sentence if I find it useful. Not everybody can do that, but I think with practice it helps.
Did he actually quit smoking?
He did not. I felt like it was a useful exercise anyway.
Well, I guess it's only one Sharpie that you lost, right? Going through the whole thing.
Yeah, exactly. It didn't take me much time. I still thought it was a good idea.
The new memoir by author Jessica Lamb Shapiro is called Promised Land, My Journey Through America's Self-Help Culture. Jessica, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure for me too. Thanks.
Jessica Lamb Shapiro joined us today from the studios of NPR in New York City. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.